I'm Nick Gillespie. I want to welcome you to a panel that we're where we're going to be talking about free expression. And part of this is we promise not to talk too much about partisan politics, although we'll get to that because it always, in the end, intersects with everything. But one of the things, as we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Reason, it's easy to look around and see darkness, especially when we're talking about government bailouts, when we're talking about still fighting two wars with no clear end in sight, things like that, and all kinds of petty or not so petty incursions into everyday life, budget meltdowns at every level of government, et cetera. One place where we can look with a lot of optimism or cautious optimism is in the broad area of free expression, of free speech, of things like that. And when you look back over the past 40 years, one of the things, a great story, and it's something that was underwritten in part by organizations like Reason that always make a very, very principled stand for free speech, for more speech, for creative speech, and for getting the government out of our minds as much as our bedrooms. You know, it's a good time to be alive. We are certainly, I think, and we'll discuss this with the panelists, but we're certainly freer to make and to produce and consume culture in an ever-growing array of circumstances that are more and more that we dictate, as opposed to cultural producers, as opposed to censors, as opposed to governments. And so we're going to be looking at that. I'm very pleased to have on the panel, and what we're going to do is each panelist will talk for a few minutes, and then we're going to have an open discussion about various things ranging from censorship laws, indecency, changes in kind of comfort levels with sexual mores, as well as drug culture and things like that. And we'll also talk about intellectual property, which in a lot of ways becomes the kind of structure through which you know, all of this can happen. Our first panelist is Martin Torgoff, who is a journalist and a producer of incredible, wonderful videos, a couple of series in particular on VH1 that you might have seen. Marty, a couple of years ago, wrote a great book called Can't Find My Way Home, which I recommend to anybody who's interested in understanding post-war popular culture and high culture. It's a tremendous work, and he also did a great series. This became the inspiration for a VH1 series called The Drug Years, which is a wonderful and very probing and nuanced look at the way in which popular culture and drug culture or depictions of drug culture intersected with popular culture. And it's a wonderful, it's not about hedonism, but it is about how American culture opened up in many wonderful ways and sometimes disturbing ways. He also has a great series that I guess is airing now, or I mean it's been out and it's on. Somebody was telling me they saw it the other day, Sex the Revolution, which is about the sexual revolution and how that cracked American society open again in a very good way. And he's got a new show that'll be airing in the fall, in the spring, right?
In the winter,
Lords of the Revolution, which will be looking at individuals, people like Andy Warhol, Timothy Leary. Who is the other person that...
Muhammad Ali.
And just the way that these people encapsulated different changes and a kind of growing proliferation of cultural identities and ideas in America. Marty, let me start with you by asking, what were the signal events in setting off not just the sexual revolution, but increasingly open cultural representations of sexual freedom and sexual identity? Is, you know, in your mind, is there one movie or film or book that or play or whatever that that you can point to where the erotic Bastille started to be emptied out?
I thought long and hard about it. And a lot of my work seems to be about attempting to understand the forces that shaped my world growing up as a teenager in the America of the 1960s, which is why, you know, I've spent so much of my career writing about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And just the power of being... I had a sister who's 4 or 5 years older than I was, and she sort of brought it all home to the basement of our parents' house on the North Shore of Long Island. And I remember seeing and picking up for the first time Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller, for example, and perusing it. And then, of course, picking up this little book here, How by Allen Ginsberg, number 4 of the famous Pocket Poets series of City Lights Press up in San Francisco. And if there's one signal event that symbolizes it to me, it's this poem and the obscenity trial that it provoked and the cultural ramifications of it. I don't know how many of you may be familiar with this poem, but it was written by Allen Ginsberg in 1955, and it was a poem that was revolutionary in its style. What Ginsberg was essentially trying to do was find a new form of poetic expression that was similar to the way the jazz musicians of the time were approaching their musical forms. He wanted a line of the poem to be very much like the breath in a saxophone line. And in terms of the imagery, he wanted a certain kind of imagery that was new, that was actually based on his experiences of marijuana, hot and cold images receding, like an image like hydrogen jukeboxes like that. And the poem was actually a recounting of his circle of friends, everything that he had seen and known and heard as a kind of subterranean, the New York of the late 1940s and into the early 50s. And he cataloged all of it in this very kind of novel, stylistic way.
Can you read the opening line, which I think most of us are familiar with, but is always stunning?
Yes, and of course now some of the terms of poetry, it's arguably now one of the most famous poems of the 20th century. And it's, I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night. Who? And then he begins, the whole rest of the first part of the poem is, that's the fixed basis, who? And on the 13th page, of course, comes the offending line. Who let themselves be fucked in the ass by saintly motorcyclists and screamed with joy. And then it goes on to say, who blew and were blown by these human seraphim, the sailors, caresses of Atlantic and Caribbean love, who bawled in the morning, in the evenings, in rose gardens, and the grass of public parks and ceremonies scattering their semen freely to whomever came who may. So it's interesting that when the censor, the book was originally published by a British publisher and imported, because Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who opened City Lights Bookstore and founded City Lights Press, he understood that there were going to be potential problems with it. So he had it published there and shipped into the country. There were 1,000 copies published, which was the first printing, and several hundred were seized on the dock of San Francisco by the police. And that was the offending line. What's interesting to...
How, quickly recap the legal history. There was a series of trials, mm-hmm. and then at what point is it resolved, and Howell enters into the annals of literature?
Okay. Well, there had been a landmark Supreme Court case that was just the month before Howell went to trial in the municipal court in San Francisco. And that was the Roth decision. And I will hand it off to Michael over here just to say a few words about the Roth decision.
Well, we'll come back to that, but I think it's clear that Ginsberg is one of the characters in the 50s. And it's interesting to think about American culture. The Beats, as well as people like Ayn Rand, as well as leftists like Paul Goodman, were all talking about the fate of the individual versus a mass society or whether it was corporate structures or communist governments or whatever. And I think Howl is definitely one of those. I mean, it is a howl, and it's a scream of individualism in a world that was worried about it, and it's one of the reasons why it continues to resonate so strongly.
Well, the mere reading of the poem was legendary in San Francisco at the Sixth Gallery, which was a converted garage turned into a cafe. And it was clear from, you know, only the 100 people in the room that just by the mere reading of the poem, something was shifting. That there was going to be a... The poem is a cultural synthesis, but it represents a paradigm shift. And in terms of what it represented in obscenity, I mean, in San Francisco, it went to trial. It was such a foregone conclusion to the prosecuting attorney that they were going to win their case, that he felt that really all he needed to do was to put someone on the stand and say, this is filthy, this is disgusting. It has the word fuck. It not only does it express an act of sodomy, but it expresses joy at an act of sodomy. So clearly this needs to be banned. And in the United States for the previous 30 years, the works of D.H. Lawrence, the works of Henry Miller, James Joyce, Edmund Wilson's Heckett County, I mean, there are just example after example of works of literature that had been banned for depicting lewdness, for rendering acts of sexuality that were considered to be morally degenerate. And but at the same time, there was the beginning of a consciousness that if it was inclusive in a work of art that had some sort of social significance, that it could no longer be taken simply out of context and be rendered obscene, that judged to be obscene simply as a result of that thing taken out of context. And it was the removal of that of the notion of obscenity from a larger work of art, which becomes the crux of all of the trials, which over the next, until like 1966, ending with the overturning of William Burroughs' Naked Lunch in Boston, which totally opens the door to an era of free speech and artistic freedom, the likes of which had never been experienced in the United States.
On that note, we'll come back to this discussion. Let me introduce Alan Gelbart, who is a great First Amendment defender, and he's representing John Stagliano of Evil Angel Productions in an ongoing obscenity charge. Very quickly, what's the status of John's case, or to the extent that you can talk about it? And then let's talk about the legal framework surrounding obscenity laws, which changed rapidly during the 60s up through the early 70s in the Miller case. Mm-hmm. And could you talk a little bit about how community standards for different types of expression, how are we moving beyond that as a means of, or are we moving beyond that as a means of saying what we are allowed to consume in our own houses?
Sure. First off, thank you for having me here. It's a real honor to address this group. John is one of my favorite clients, if not my favorite client, and it's an honor and a privilege to be able to represent him. As for the status of John's case, he was indicted last November. I think he found out about it in a press release from the Department of Justice. They didn't do us the courtesy of calling us up and going, oh, by the way, you're indicted. And what has happened is we've put together a legal team. I'm not the only defender here. I like to think I was the first, but we have a fantastic team. Paul Cambria, who is widely known as Larry Flint's attorney, H. Lewis Serkin, who is my sort of idol and mentor, who is the gentleman that defended the Mapplethorpe photographs in Cincinnati and also won the Ashcroft versus Free Speech Coalition case before the United States Supreme Court, and Bob Korn Revere, who is a well-respected Reason member. We've put a team together of lawyers who we think will be hopefully defending this quite well. By the way, when you see these four people, and you know, including me, I always like to think, well, which one of these guys doesn't fit? With the status of the case at this point is this. We have filed a motion to dismiss. There are three principal defendants. When the government goes after a case like this, they never just say, okay, John, you're a defendant. And the reason they don't do that is for every defendant they pick, you got to hire another lawyer, and it becomes an expensive proposition. And that, believe me, is part of their game here. Two of the individual entities that John owns are defendants, and so each one of them has to have its own lawyer. And because they brought this in the District of Columbia and none of us practice there, we have to have local counsel, and so that's Mr. Corn Revere's job. We have filed a motion to dismiss this case and various portions of the case based on various existing legal theories and extensions of recent Supreme Court law that we hope will prevail.
Could you, very quickly, for people who aren't familiar with the case, what are the actual charges?
Well, the charges I'll narrow them down to two. There are, I think, nine counts. One is that John essentially distributed obscene DVDs into the jurisdiction. And the other is, I love the way they do this, they artfully worded this, that he has made obscene materials available or has sent obscene materials to minors. Now, when you read actually into what the charge is, he made a trailer from his website available in a place where minors might be able to get it. And by that, the government means on the internet. So they're really two different things. And they word these things on purpose because as soon as somebody says minors, that, you know, people's heads explode. This case is not about child pornography. This is not about, you know, sending DVDs, you know, to the fifth grade class at the District of Columbia High School.
Although that is part of Barack Obama's, wasn't that one of his campaign pledges?
Don't get me started. I'm a social Democrat, yeah. And I have strong libertarian tendencies in certain areas. One of the things that Barack Obama said in his debates when they were talking about the right of choice, when they were talking about the abortion issue, and this is a man who very carefully chooses his words, he said, I believe that the Constitution involves a right of privacy. Now, the privacy elements that are there to protect a woman's right to choose are also there to protect your rights to watch what you want in the privacy of your own home. And that really is the sort of central focus in our case for John. Getting back to the formalities of it, we filed our motions. The government filed an opposition, which said, no. There are years of Supreme Court cases that say these guys are wrong. And our response to that, which was filed a number of weeks ago, was, except, you know, that was 1973, and there have been many years of Supreme Court cases that have changed that. And the most important of them is Lawrence versus Texas. And I want to read a line from that case. I love this. This is another, I'll just read it. Liberty protects the person from an unwarranted government intrusions into a dwelling or other private places. In our tradition, the state is not omnipresent in the home, and there are other spheres of our lives and existence outside the home where the state should not be a dominant presence. Freedom extends beyond spatial bounds. Liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, belief, expression, and certain intimate conduct. The instant case, which was talking about the right to engage in homosexual sodomy, involves the liberty of persons both in its spatial and its more transcendent dimensions. Now, that is not just saying, hey, gays have a right to have sex in the butt, okay? And the Supreme Court could have done that. And the case that came before it, which was Bowers versus Hardwick, that's what the Supreme Court in the 80s said what these gay rights cases is about. And the Supreme Court, just a number of years ago, said, no, you guys missed the point. It's not about the particular act. It's about whether the government has a right to pry into people's private lives in these areas. And they got it wrong then, and we're wholly throwing out that entire concept. The government doesn't have a right to get into your private stuff when it has to do with sex. Now, we're not talking about kids, and we're not talking about barnyard animals. We're talking about consenting adults in the privacy of your own home. Now, our central focus in defending John and in defending freedom of expression in the sexual area is this. Assume for the sake of argument that the obscenity jurisprudence is sound, and believe me, I do not agree with that at all, and hope to talk about that more in a few minutes. Irrespective of whether a work is obscene or not, and whether members of my community thinks this will make their heads explode somehow, I have a right in the privacy of my own home to watch a particular movie. And if I want to masturbate to it, that's fine. And if I want to think about it, it's fine. And if I want to just sit there and throw spit wads at the TV thinking how terrible this is, that's fine too. But that's my right as an American citizen in an area regarding sex. I should be able to do this in the privacy of my own home. And if that is in fact the law, and we truly think it is, then someone else has to be able to get you those materials to watch in the first place. And that's John's position. So that's where we are now. There will be a hearing in the District of Columbia in front of a judge a week from this coming Tuesday where the government and we will argue this matter. This judge is a George W. Bush appointee who has very strong Republican bona fides. And that generally made us very concerned, except the very first question he asked the prosecutor when we had our little pretrial conference was, what are we doing here? And
they could be going over to your living room.
Yeah. And I, of course, I have this sort of almost disrespectful sense of humor about these things. I said, you know, are we talking jurisdictionally or existentially?
Yeah.
And everybody sort of giggled. He goes, no. I mean, why are we here? This isn't Alabama. This isn't, you know, this isn't a place where you would normally see an obscenity prosecution brought. Why are we in the District of Columbia? And the prosecutor said to the judge, well, you know, I'm here and my kids are here and we want to try this here. And most of us went, huh? You know, that makes no sense at all. And I think the actual answer to that can be found in the report that involved, from the Office of Inspector General, that involved the fired U.S. attorneys, those nine U.S. attorneys. By the way, two of those were fired for refusal to participate in obscenity prosecutions, for those of you who aren't aware of that. What it says in there is that this sort of small cadre of true believer lawyers that the government has put together to go after adult obscenity. I'm not talking child porn. I'm talking consenting adults for consenting adults. They've been going around the country trying to bring these actions against people. And the U.S. attorneys in these various jurisdictions are going, not in my backyard. I don't have time for this. This is ridiculous. You know, what people do in the privacy of their own home is no one's business but theirs. And my favorite example of all of this is a gentleman named Dan Bogden, who was the U.S. attorney in Nevada. And the government brought him one of these cases, and he went, uh-uh. And there was a whole bunch of U.S. people, Department of Justice people that went to Nevada to have a meeting with him. And he went, uh-uh, I'm not doing this here. Ain't going to happen. And he's, of course, one of the nine U.S. attorneys that's fired. Now, think about this. Obscenity is judged by contemporary community standards. Prostitution is legal in Nevada. So you can buy sex, but you can't watch it on TV? Please!
No.
All right.
Well, let's... I think they bring it in D.C. because it's the sodomy capital of America.
Well,
because people are all getting screwed.
Someone's getting screwed six ways to Sunday.
But let's bring Michael Robertson into the conversation. Michael created a great early website, a way of listening to your music, mp3.com. Michael, the 90s and the rise of digital culture represented what a liberation from what George Gilder and other theorists of the net or of digital culture called hierarchical broadcasting, the idea that you would have one main maker or producer of culture and then beam it out to other places. You were doing something different. And it became more hierarchical, or it's ground up, it's decentralized, things like that. And it was working. Then the lawsuits came in the 90s against MP3.com, against Napster, against Grokster, against other types of file sharing services. Do you feel that we're delivering on the promise of that early digital culture, or are we still hemmed in by legal structures that both Marty and Alan have talked about?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background,
yep.
And then I'll answer your question.
Yep.
So at MP3.com, what I did, I started this company about 10 years ago. I wanted to start a digital music company. I met with all the record labels, and they said, we're not going to give you any music. Well, that makes it hard to have a music site when they say, we won't give you music. And the major record labels, they control 85, 90% of the music. So I decided, well, why don't I just make a system where any artist in the world can publish their music, and I'll host it for free, no charge, and we'll just see what happens. And this was really one of the first, you know, user publishing, you know, hey, I just upload it, and I type in all the band names and upload the picture of the drummer, and bam, I'm published to the world. And that's what we did, and it created a big explosion in traffic, and we quickly became the number one digital music site in the world with no music from the major record labels. We weren't sued for that. What we were sued for was the subsequent technology where I started thinking, all right, where does this go? Well, everything is moving to the cloud, or you know, which is another name for the internet. What if your personal music could be in the internet, and then you could access it from anywhere? But the problem is all of your personal music that you care about today is locked up in CDs. And those CDs are very big. So how do you get them to the internet? We built this brilliant little technology that would look at sort of the DNA of a CD, precisely determine what CD that was, and then instantly activate those songs for your personal listening. So you couldn't give them to anybody else. It was just your personal listening experience. And it was that's what we were sued for. And we were sued for hundreds of billions of dollars. So to answer your question, are we realizing the promise? Where are we? Well, the law is really, really slanted for copyright owners. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Let's say you and I are in the parking garage here at the hotel, and I back my car into your car. Well, you could sue me, and you'd have to prove two things. One, that it was my fault, and two, that you were harmed. But imagine if you didn't have to prove any harm. Imagine if you could just say, hey, I was sitting in my car, the guy bumped me, and imagine if you didn't have to prove any harm, you could get, I don't know, $15,000 to $150,000. That would be a big incentive to sue, right? Now imagine if that wasn't limited to just $15,000 to $150,000 per incident, but if it was related to music or movies, for every work. So you set up a website, every movie you have on your website, $15,000 to $150,000 guaranteed if you win. Well, that is a huge incentive if you're a media company to go sue people. And that's why today, right now, there are more lawsuits against individuals, more lawsuits against companies, and more lawsuits against personal people, like they sued me personally in the most recent case that I'm involved with, by media companies. Why? Because if they can prove copyright infringement, they have a guaranteed victory without proving $1 of harm. So that's a huge incentive, and that's why you have so many lawsuits even today. And that's not going to change, because that's codified in the law. It's called statutory damages. Now, the good news, so that's the bad news, right? The good news is times are changing, and today's courts are getting a lot more savvy about digital media. And really, this is tied to the new generation of law clerks. When you think about the court system, you know, one of the most important elements is who's your judge, right? We heard Alan mention that. Who's the judge? What's he like, right? Because he is God in his courtroom. But behind the scenes, he's got some clerks, recent, you know, law school graduates that are doing the busy work for him and say, listen, let me tell you how things work. And now you have this new generation of people that have grown up around MP3s and digital libraries and YouTube and things like that, and they're starting to infiltrate these courts into a digital awareness that I think is tilting the scale. And we've seen that most recently, just in the last 3 months, with two very important cases. I'll tell you about one. It's called Cablevision. It's a cable company out of New York. They wanted to give all their customers a TiVo. But that's expensive to, you know, put a big box in everyone's house and the truck has to go install it and things like that. So they said, well, why don't we build a central system, a big central system, and we'll just send people a cheap $15 remote. And when they say record, the signal will go back to the central office, hit record, and it's recorded. And when they click play, it'll play from the central office. Now, that's great because you build one machine and everyone in your business can sign up for the service. Well, the media company sued them. This is by media companies, I mean the movie companies and the music companies. And they said that's an infringement because Cablevision is doing the copying, not the user. Now, Cablevision said, hey, what's the difference if the TiVo's in the person's house or the hard disk or where it's stored happens to be at the corner of the block or even at a remote office? There is no difference. Well, the lower court judge ruled absolutely against Cablevision on all counts. Very bad ruling, but they appealed. And the appellate court just recently, last 2 months, passed down a fabulous ruling. legalizing what what Cablevision is doing. What they said was, hey, when the user pushes the button on the remote, it's the user that's making the recording. It doesn't matter where the machinery happens to be. And when they play it back, it's not a public performance, which was the absurd position that the music companies were taking. It's into a private home. It's a private performance. So that was a fantastic ruling. I think one of the recent ones that gives guys like me hope, because there's a new lawsuit that I'm involved in that's very much around, you know, personal music ownership, that maybe the courts are getting more savvy about technology.
Marty, are you bullish on the near future? We'll talk about the longer-term future of free expression. Are you bullish about the near term?
Well,
optimistic,
I mean,
pessimistic?
Yes and no. I mean, it depends. It's qualified in whatever area. I mean, having now told the story of the sexual revolution, you know, it's interesting to note that upon the 50th anniversary of this poem, it was no longer possible to have it read on the air,
right,
because of the pushback to these freedoms.
Right.
You know, and a lot happened beginning in the 1980s. I mean, you know, this became the basis of a culture war. It was really the first shot across the bow, you know, and it led to many things in the society. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to about their work, whether, you know, it was Bob Dylan or, you know, a filmmaker like Scorsese, in which, you know, they cited this poem as the inspiration, as the impetus for their own free expression. But no sooner, and that gave rise to many changes in the culture, seismic shifts in the culture, that became the basis of what we now know as the culture wars. In 1966, Ronald Reagan comes into office as governor of California, and the police go into the Haight-Ashbury, and they bust Lenore Kandel's love book, for obscenity. And they shut Michael McClure's production of a play called The Beard, in which Billy the Kid performs cunnilingus on Jean Harlow, which is kind of an interesting scenario.
I just lost the thread of our conversation.
By the 1980s, you know, there's, you know, warfare in the courts, whether it's over pornography, and you see it sort of go on into the 90s and the present day. So this is a constant dynamic push-pull going on.
Well, and it's interesting with Reagan as president, when he got rid of the Fairness Doctrine, actually opened up avenues of for free speech. So it's interesting.
It is.
Even as his attorney general was going nuts over porn. Mm-hmm. I mean, what that means.
It's very paradoxical. I mean, when I did the sexual revolution for VH1, it was a co-production of the Sundance Channel and VH1. So on the one hand, I was able to do a version of it that was completely uncensored for Sundance. The one in VH1 was censored. And it was a tremendous irony to me to be telling a story in which part of the story was about the overturning of censorship, to be censored.
Yeah.
Now, how was I censored? Bodies were blurred, breasts were black barred, and specifically words. There was a part in the first hour, which where the clip was from, that was about the filthy speech movement in Berkeley, which was an adjunct of the free speech movement. And what they wanted to do was they would stand up and, you know, at Sproul Plaza and basically read from Lady Chatterley's Lover, and they'd be arrested and led away. But they were making a point. And there was a part in the show in which someone says the word fuck, and then someone says the word pussy, 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 like that, and it was bleep, bleep, bleep.
You know, we will be bleeping this for Reason TV. But here's the question, because, you know, to get off strictly legal issues or something, is it censorship if you have two versions, if you have a G-rated version and an X-rated or an adult? And I'm sympathetic. It's a great irony.
Yeah.
But is that a bad thing if that also allows your work to be seen by more people?
You know, yes and no. I mean, that's a very good question. And, you know, and I've had to think about these things not only from the standpoint of someone who believes in, you know, free and unfettered expression. I mean, if there's one area in which I am a purist libertarian, it is in this area. I mean, I have always believed that, that a society that censors itself not only limits freedom but has no confidence in it. It does not engender, it does not develop confidence in itself, in its sensibilities, in its institutions. In the beginning of my book on the drug culture, I quote a line from the Tao Te Ching, which states, in effect, if you try to make a people moral, you sow the seeds of vice. And I believe that, and that's a spiritual axiom to me that, yeah, I believe in.
And it's something I'm going to keep away from my kids for as long as possible. Alan, are you optimistic about Obama an Obama administration in terms of obscenity and indecency prosecutions, that it'll go away? And I raise this partly, and I think somebody mentioned it before, in a 2007 speech, Obama famously instructed people to turn off the TV, to turn off the video games, mm-hmm, turn off the computer, which is an irony that the baby boomer parent would be telling people to get the hell away from a computer. But he also said, and we talked a little bit about this at lunch yesterday, like Janet Reno, he said, you know, the entertainment industry has to clean up its act, and if they don't do that, an Obama administration will regulate it. Mm-hmm. And he's big on regulating video games, things like that.
I'm guardedly optimistic about the Obama campaign, and I have a number of reasons for that. One of them just came out in the last few days. A gentleman named Dan Ogden is being selected to work with Obama's the committees that, you know, put together the areas of government that are going to be put together now. Mr. Ogden is a former member and an officer of the Free Speech Coalition, the First Amendment Lawyers Association, of which I am a member. And we are the guys that are out there that defend core political speech and adult entertainment. He's going to be involved in helping Obama pick people for the Department of Justice and hopefully an attorney general. So I am somewhat guardedly optimistic. I also think that when you talk about the types of regulations, you have to look at sort of the whole area that Obama has spoken about, not just specifics. Because if you say regulation, you know, some people might think that means content regulation. And obviously none of us are really big fans of that. One of the famous phrases in First Amendment law, and it's sort of the root of all evil if you think about it, is you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. We've always heard that as the reason that the government doesn't have to follow the Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech part of the First Amendment. And so, you know, the court says, well, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. And I would profess that that is actually not true. I think you can yell fire in a crowded theater when there's a fire, okay? So what you've got is not that the content is wrong, but the context of the delivery of the content is wrong. Now, I am not going to sit here and tell you that it should be okay for a pornographer to deliver, you know, hardcore pornography to someone who doesn't want to see it. There are certainly people that are shocked and offended by this stuff. And it's not for me to say you should have to watch it. But as George Carlin famously said when his works were under, you know, attack, look, the radio has two knobs. One turns it off and the other one changes the channel. What is really crucial here is that content-based restrictions on speech are and must inherently be frowned upon because, you know, one of the famous axioms that comes out of First Amendment law is the remedy for disfavored speech is not censorship, it's other speech. So if you don't like pornography, fine. Don't watch it and preach against it. There's plenty of people out there that are doing that.
Do you
The problem I have is when they say, well, you shouldn't be able to watch it. And that's where I draw the line.
Where do you, and especially if you're coming out of a kind of liberal democratic background, how does that intersect with things like campus speech codes, which seem to be largely coming from a liberal end of the political spectrum? And it's specifically about content regulation. It is about the ideas. So.
I depart from my social democrat friends in a lot of areas. I am a First Amendment purist, and that's one of the areas where I consider myself more of a libertarian. There are certain types of things that, you know, are problematic on school campuses. You don't want to start a riot, all right? And you don't, you know, you don't want to permit someone to be espousing an idea on a campus where, you know, 5 minutes from now, people are going to be running with torches to burn down the administration building. But the Supreme Court has looked at that area.
Can you give some support for that argument?
There's a doctrine in Supreme Court law, which is the Brandenburg versus Hayes decision. And it talks about sort of incitement of illegal conduct. Now, there's a difference between saying, look, I think the government is wrong and you should go out there and do everything you can to overthrow the government and throw these bums out. It's another thing to be standing on the steps of the school and saying, those guys over there are bad people and you should burn them and kill them, where you know that if you do this, you know, well enough, the people are actually going to go and burn them and kill them. There are competing interests there. And as a First Amendment purist, I believe that, you know, burning a cross on a black person's front lawn is not something that we should allow because someone's going to get killed, okay? And, you know, it's the same thing. Publishing the plans for a hydrogen bomb in the New York Times, you know, okay, that's free speech unless someone takes those plans and builds one and blows up New York. So there are always reasonable balancing things here, but the sort of clear and present danger element has been sort of shunned by the Supreme Court lately. And what they've done is they've said, well, we just assume this kind of stuff harms people. And my favorite one, by the way, and I know this makes me very unpopular, is the harmful to minors concept. There's a whole other doctrine of law that's sort of related to obscenity, which is called harmful to minors. Obscenity is a three-part test. And what they do with that is they say, for example, the first part of obscenity is whether the work, applying contemporary community standards, taken as a whole, appeals to a prurient interest in sex or excretion as regards to minors. Okay? Now, they do that with all three prongs. My first question is, where's the proof that this kind of stuff hurts kids in the first place? I don't think there is any. And the reason there isn't is because we're so sure that it will that we won't test it. I mean, you're not going to show your 10-year-old hardcore pornography to see if it makes their heads explode because you are assuming that it will hurt them. Let's assume for the sake of arguments that it will, okay? There are reasonable ways to protect minors, but it's not the producers of the material's responsibility. It's the parents' responsibility. And you can't make the world safe for the sandbox, all right? There are going to be ideas out there that really shouldn't be, you know, exposed to children. But I suggest to you that what we're really doing is we are trying to protect the parents' obligation to explain to the kids what they have actually just seen, which embarrasses and makes the parents uncomfortable. That's really what we're doing. And if you're going to be a parent, you have an obligation to that kid and to the rest of society to teach the kid about what's going on. And if you can't explain to your kids about sex, then you probably shouldn't be having them in the first place. That's my humble opinion.
Can I just interject
yeah,
something?
Yeah, sure, please.
You know, classically, historically, however you want to look at it, censorship just doesn't work.
No.
It's a remarkably ineffective way of repressing thought and speech because it just, you know, water finds its own level. I mean, in the case of Hal, no sooner did they censor it and bring it to trial than it became famous/notorious. And Ferlinghetti said the censor managed to accomplish in one day what book critics couldn't have accomplished in a whole year.
Yeah.
And you see it over and over again. I mean, in the instances of film, the one film that, like, really broke down the wall, so to speak, was I Am Curious Yellow.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that is a remarkably boring film in which the characters, you know, pontificate about socialism, and then they have some sex.
Right.
Now, you know, so as soon as as soon as it became a cause célèbre, an example of a censored work, everyone went to see it, and it became a phenomenon. And you see it, you see that just over and over, and mind-numbing predictability.
But I think when it comes to Obama, listen, I think a rational person is going to see a little less censorship craziness than the Bush administration. But there's a different threat that you will see more of, and that is linking up arms with the commercial side of things. And let me give you an example. The media companies and music companies right now, they plead, we are losing tens of billions of dollars to this damn internet. You got to do something about it. And so just recently, University of Tennessee, they've been putting pressure on colleges and say, listen, we're going to start suing all your kids unless you do something. So what do? Well, all right, we'll turn off P2P, right? Peer-to-peer transfer. Now, why is that important? Well, go try to put your porn on YouTube. They ain't going to take it, right? YouTube doesn't take porn. So you got to find a different way to do it. Well, these colleges, when they shut down P2P, they can't tell what's actually being transferred. They're just going to go, hey, man, if it's a movie file, stop, the end. And that's what you're going to see. So it's not going to be, I think, from a censorship angle as much as a, hey, we need to protect American jobs, right? Because if they're copying movies, people aren't getting paid, actors are losing their jobs. That's terrible for our economy, and that's what you're
seeing. And in a way, it's also a rearguard action in that it will make it more difficult, but it's not actually going to stop a migration of
files. Yeah, that's the beauty of the internet. Most of these politicians haven't figured out the internet's global yet, that's working in our favor. Yeah.
I wanted to comment on that because, I mean, I became a First Amendment defender sort of by accident. I was in the adult business and got prosecuted and got angry. And this was in the sort of...
Did your parents, by the way, did they explain sex to you?
They did actually. I remember... First, there are two things I remember. One is I remember my parents going to see I Am Curious Yellow. I was probably 5, 6, 7. And I remember them coming home and talking about this going, that was the most boring thing I've ever seen. And my parents were like the most conservative, like little old Jewish parents you've ever seen.
You're getting to a point about copyright.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about copyright for a second. My thought was not to be a lawyer. My plan was to be a pornographer with a law degree. And what I wanted to do, really, was to start sort of an internet company. And my introduction to John was not in defending obscenity. It was dealing with piracy. I represented Evil Angel in a series of cases where we found a guy up in Canada who was burning counterfeit DVDs and selling them everywhere, and we got an $11 million jury verdict. I mean, these kinds of things don't usually go to juries. Usually the company just vanishes. And by the way, we had a judge who was another G.W. Bush appointee who did everything he could to make us lose that case.
Is the case, and this might be a real point of friction, actually, among some people on the... Is it that they were counterfeit DVDs, so they were passing it off as Evil Angel? For instance, and John and I guess, have talked about this, and Michael, I'd be interested in your sense, or Marty, as somebody who works with big entertainment companies, would it be okay if somebody said this is not an authorized Evil Angel production?
No. And here's why.
And Michael, I suspect that you might have a different take on that.
The thing you have to understand about, and Michael talked about statutory damages earlier on, the right to create art is sort of an inherent thing, but our copyright and patent law actually derives from the Constitution. And our framers, our founders of this country, recognized that they wanted art and science and things to develop. And the only way in a free market economy for that to happen is to give people a limited monopoly in the fruits of their labor.
Yeah, but now you have to prove that, because in fashion, this is not the case. In
cuisine, it is.
Well, it's becoming, but I mean, in fact, it isn't. I mean, anybody can do a knockoff, and as long as you're not misrepresenting the product. So there are areas where there is massive amounts of innovation and production of creative expression without any kind of copyright protection.
There are certain types of things that are not, for one reason or another, copyrightable. But when you're talking about works of music, works of authorship, books, movies, things like that, people spend a lot of money on this. And in order to make it worthwhile to do these things, you have to be able to recoup on your investment. I mean, this is as free market capitalism kind of idea as you can get.
Right.
And it is a property right. The concept of intellectual property incorporates this. Now, if I own a movie and, you know, I sell a copy to you, you can sell that copy to anyone else you want. That's called the first sale doctrine. So if I buy a copy of a DVD and I watch it, I'm like, that was okay, I want to sell it on eBay, that should be okay. What's not okay is to make a million copies of it and sell it to everybody else. Or to share it with everybody else, because you demonetize.
Right, but I think you're oversimplifying the copyright law. The copyright law is not meant there to protect someone's wallet, right? The copyright law is actually to encourage creativity. That's the premise. And the example of, hey, I take your DVD and I go to a DVD burner and I make copies and I just sell it and take money, that's a pretty straightforward example. Let's take a different example. I got a 10-year-old. His friend has a show called Cooking with Joe and Milos that he puts episodes up on YouTube. He has background music. Now what happens, right? That background music, he didn't write it, right? He just has the radio turned to a song that he likes. That's where the lines get a lot blurrier when the internet comes along and you have mashups and new young people being creative in ways that were unfathomed when the copyright law was first brought to light. And that's where I think this strict, hey, if you're the original author, you're the only guy who can make a copy, period, end of story, totally falls apart.
Well, and I do think that people will make porn even if they can't recoup their initial investment.
They may make it in their private lives, but from a commercial perspective, this, probably not.
I mean, this is actually a really interesting kind of frontier in libertarian thought, because there is, I mean, I think your point is extremely well drawn, and then Michael's, yours is as well, and that we're in a world now, regardless of what the law says, because of technology and because of people's creativity and ways around things, we'll be working through this like a, you know, like a forest at night. Let's open it up for some questions, please.
I had a question for Michael, actually. You're talking about the statutory damages issues with some of these copyright cases, and I was wondering what you think about the new developments towards lower statutory damages, like Capital v. Thomas, where they're sort of judges are starting to resist that movement and starting to say, well, you know, with personal suits, like, this is a bit extreme and it's a bit much to be holding these people for hundreds of thousands of dollars of damages just for songs. I'm just interested.
Right. So the case that he's referring to is one where an individual was sued because they were doing P2P and they were sharing some files. And, of course, the music industry went after him for the statutory damages. And no judge can realistically look at the numbers. And when a person's sharing, you know, 1,000 files times the minimum, which is $15,000, and say that's an equitable resolution. And so the notion was, if it's an innocent behavior that they didn't know would lead to this, then they could, you know, take it down to $200 per work. I mean, it's positive because what you're trying to see is, to me, you're seeing the judges go, that doesn't make sense, right? Yeah, we have to follow the law, but hey, at the same time, I got to go home and my kid's doing P2P music sharing and I got to make, you know, sense of all this. And so I think it's a positive development that they're seeing this is way out of line.
The statutory damages provisions of the copyright code are a little bit more sort of modern thinking than most people think. For starters, the initial damages amount, if you prove that you've won your case and you've copyrighted and someone else has infringed, is between $1,500 and $30,000 per misuse. Now, if the defendant can show that it was an unintentional infringement, that can go down to $250 per misuse. If you prove that it was intentional infringement, and you have to prove that by clear and convincing evidence, the judge has the ability to go up to $150,000. So what you're looking at here is sort of
that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. It's per work. Right. So we're in a digital world, right? We're a digital world where people are able to work with tens of thousands of items. So take all the numbers that Alan said and add four zeros to it, right? And tell me, does that make sense? No, it clearly doesn't. And that's so you can say it's modern. It's not modern. It's antiquated. Well, realizing we live in a digital world where, you know, we're talking about petabytes and gigabytes and terabytes.
Well, it's interesting, too. I mean, there is not an attempt to make a specific finding that this song, that this copy was worth $250 in foregone sales or anything like that. I mean, it's not actually researched in any given instance.
Here's the reason for that. When you bring a copyright action to enforce your damages, someone you've made a painting and someone's making copies of it and selling them. If you have to prove what they made, keeping in mind what it costs to bring one of these actions in the first place, okay, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's not worth your time and your lawyer's bills to go sue some guy for knocking off a copy if you could have bought an original, say, of a work on iTunes for 99 cents, you're going to say, well, okay, I lost 99 cents. So there has to be some teeth in the law that says, well, if you do this, we're going to make it painful for you. And the other element of this is there's a dissuasive element of this, which is, you know, if you're messing up a little bit, we're going to make it a little bit painful. But if you're a company that's out there commercially infringing, and that's your main source of revenue, we're going to make it really dissuasive.
Alan, your roots are showing through, my friend. I mean,
I'm proud of my roots.
Let's make speeding, you know, $1 million and nobody will speed, right? Let's make it dissuasive. Come on. Yeah.
There's
stop
a
already. When you're talking about commercial,
stealing.
Yeah, but when you talk about commercial versus non-commercial, you use the example of, I take your work, I make DVDs, I sell them.
Right.
I think everyone in the room says, hey, man, you kind of took some of his stuff.
But, hey,
right? But,
Michael,
but the lines are a lot blurrier than that on the internet.
What's the difference?
Other way, though, would you, I mean, are you, like, what would be the remedy in that case, in the case that Alan was talking about with counterfeit Evil Angel DVDs? Are you comfortable that the business got sued out of business or had an $11 million fine against it?
I have no problem with a company going after something close to actual damages. The problem is when you get into the digital world, that notion of, hey, I got to get the guy he's selling DVDs out of his trunk, I can't prove how many he sold, so I want to use his statutory damages. Yeah. Hey, that makes sense. When you move to the internet and the person is not selling them at all, right? They simply happen to be using them in some ancillary non-commercial way to use that same hammer to go after that individual, I think is absurd. And,
well,
and that's why you have judges who are making new law while charging
$200.
I was going to ask about something else, but how is it absurd when record companies are going out of business?
Yep.
How is that absurd?
Hey,
the
just
whole
because
world
a company
changed
is going out of business doesn't mean they're great. Look at GM. They're going out of business. They made crappy cars for 40 years.
Yeah, but
apples and oranges.
But the
it's not apples and oranges at all. It is not
Listen,
apples and oranges.
If I make a piece of music and you burn it onto a CD and sell it or give it to somebody else, you've cost me the same number of sales, right?
No, you haven't because the fallacy of that argument is this. Would the person have bought it in the first place?
It's obvious they would. A lot of people would have bought it. Look what happened to the record companies. Look at what happened to the quality of music today. It's down.
That notion about the quality of music is down is bunk. People have been saying that every decade.
Well, you know, okay.
There's no good music anymore, right?
I had another question.
It's interesting because it is true that, like, if I can download a song for free, I might listen to it. If I have to pay even a nickel, maybe not. You know, and so there is no damage, right? John, did you want to...
I had another question.
You want to go
you
back
guys
to
are
I
confused.
Am Curious Yellow?
No, it's about property rights. And Martin didn't make it clear who did the censorship on his thing, whether or not it was...
Oh, the Viacom censor.
If they did the
network censor. There is somebody... The standards department, you know, who looks at everything and says,
we can't have that.
Let me just speak first. Yep. If this is a private company and they simply want to present this particular image in our private business, that's one thing. If they have pressure from the government, whether worrying about consequences, that's another thing.
Well, it's obvious pressure from the government because it's a situation where...
Okay, then it's censorship. I can see that. I really wanted to ask another point, and the point is about speech on college campuses. Which is, you know, a college campus is an institution or a private school where kids are bringing guns in or whatever is a school. It's a place where my daughter goes to school. I would like to send my daughter to a school where nobody is allowed to stand up and start using swear words. Or somebody might want to send their kid to a school where people are allowed to do that. It's a question of property. What confuses everything is that schools and roads and everything is public property. Because it's public property, people feel that you can debate the idea of free speech in relation to public property. That fucks everything up because it's public property. If it was a private school, it's the owners of the school to decide what kind of education they want to sell to the parents for their kids. And that their decisions would be related to whether or not kids could bring guns to school, whether or not kids could bring Advil to school, whether or not kids could say sexual things or swear words on a college campus. It's up to the college campus to decide, and it's up to the people who want to go to that school to decide if that's the kind of school they want to go to. It's not about free speech. It's about property rights, and it screws everything up when you start saying whether or not it's a free speech issue that people can talk on campus at Berkeley, because that's not what it's about.
That's actually exactly correct. There's a difference in schooling, when you're talking about a public forum like a state college and a private school, I mean,
right.
I don't have a right to go to Liberty University and espouse atheistic theory because it's a private university. They're God-loving folk, and they have the ability to target their message as they see fit. On the other hand, if I want to go to UCLA and espouse atheistic theory, and they've just had a somebody spout, you know, Judeo-Christian theory, that raises a whole different issue. Censorship only becomes an issue in the constitutional sense when the government has a hand in it. Private censorship within the context of, you know, private rights is really not looked at by the Constitution.
I think we're going to end on that note. Thank you very
much.
We'll continue the conversation.
Respectfully agree with this.
That was wonderful. Thank you, buddy.